Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm back with anarchist filmmaker Franklin Lopez, who was in Cancun, Mexico, outside the security fences. He's reporting on the protests in Mexico there at the climate summit. Let's get going. We see the climate camp model has happened in the UK and Britain, but hardly anywhere in North America that I'm aware of. Do you know of some climate camps that have happened in Canada or the United States?
Yeah, I know that this summer in Montreal, there was a climate camp, although I was not able to make it. But even like within the context of outside of the climate activism, the G20 in Toronto, I mean, that would have been an amazing place to actually have something like that. Although one of the organizing groups there did something that I had never seen done in Canada, and it maybe has to do with my little time in Canada. But they actually provided food during one of the actions, food before the march and food after the march. And that really made it easy and affordable for people to do this. So I think that for organizers in Mexico, that was an amazing way to get people who are essentially poor. I mean, most of the people that came to these camps were rural Mexicans who were there to basically say that the climate is destroying their crops, the climate is affecting their lives. They had some clear demands. Regardless of whether or not you sit on the, you know, anarchist side, which is, you know, wants to reject the talks altogether, or if you're part of the people who want to beg the government for change. I think in a sense, like climate activism is a very privileged type of activism. People in the first world can really actually take the time to look at these, at the science, and look at these predictions that are going to happen, even the stuff that's happening right now, and actually do activism around something that may or may not affect them in the present, right? When you look at places like Mexico or Latin America, they have their plate full. They're already dealing with land issues. They're already trying to preserve their culture. There's still many indigenous people who live in Mexico who are day in, day out trying to protect, you know, what's left of their land. They do understand what climate change is, what it's doing. Reality is at their door, and they're fighting, you know, super projects like dams, like highway expansions, forced relocations into what they're calling rural cities, is what they're calling in Chiapas, I think, where they're basically trying to get, you know, campesinos, like farmers, to move to these, you know, planned communities and basically leave the land alone for the government to use for whatever else.
What were some of the actions that you saw there that could inspire us?
Well, like I said, I was there mostly to report on the activities of the anti-capitalist bloc, and they had certainly a small contingent within the larger mobilization there. Their very first action, which they actually held a spokes council the day before to decide what they wanted to do, was to go to an agency called the Profepa. And the Profepa, it's an acronym that basically, it's the Ministry of the Environment in Mexico. And these are the folks who are supposed to be protecting the environment, but just like in the United States or in other countries, you know, they actually facilitate the building of super projects like dams, et cetera. So the action was to try to go in front of the actual building, the actual government building. And since people felt that the Profepa was, pardon my French, was pooping on them, then they were going to poop on the Profepa. So they gathered an enormous amount of excrement, and they had a catapult, and they were actually headed over there. But, you know, the action was pretty well known, and riot police blocked the way. So the only people who got pelted with the poop were the riot police.
Were there any signs of violence, or did things go peacefully?
When you go to protests in North America, you certainly see like large numbers of police, really well armed, usually with less lethal weapons, tear gas, flashbang grenades, and whatnot. In Mexico City and Cancun, the police had fully automatic rifles. You saw it everywhere. It was like an occupied city. And even within the face of that potential police violence, people were amazingly fearless. But people understood also that they were outnumbered. Also, people understood that there was an action that was reached consensus on that action, and that people were not going to break consensus. So as much as there were some people who really wanted to have it out with the cops and try to get to the actual building, once it was understood that there was probably one policeman for every protester, the marchers decided to just basically turn back and just have a party.
You say anti-capitalist, so are you saying that these talks really just shouldn't happen because governments are betraying us anyway, or that it's all going to the World Bank? Talk to us about that.
One of the things that really bothers me about the environmental movement when I look at the big NGOs, the big NGOs, as they are called, is that they do not have an anti-capitalist analysis. You know, I'm not saying that things couldn't have gone this way if the world was ruled by socialism or communism. But in the end, capitalism is the name of the game right now, and capitalism requires exponential growth in order to survive. And we live in a finite world, and we can't do that. So the anti-capitalists have a very nuanced but yet very clear analysis that in order for the destruction of the planet to end, we need to end capitalism. We really need a full system change. So as we have seen through the years when it comes to these talks, you know, groups like the WTO and the IMF and the World Bank and the G20, when these folks meet, they're usually don't have the people's future, the people's well-being at stake. As anti-capitalists, and I include myself in that group, we really think that what we do at these mobilizations is show people the farce that's happening behind the fence and basically hope that our discourse makes them change their tactics so that they actually use tactics that are going to lead them to victory, that are going to lead us to actually protect our world. To a certain degree, like, I'm amazingly disappointed in Cancun on many different levels. On another, I'm glad that things failed behind the fence as it was expected, even though the folks behind the fence claim victory, and that people start to see the reality that we don't have unlimited time to do this. So we really need to think of what are the things that are going to stop the destruction of the planet.
Is there anything you'd like to add as we wrap up here?
The movement in Mexico concerning the COP16 was extremely divided. The two main camps, as I mentioned, Via Campesina and Espacio Mexicano, or Mexican Space, had some serious infighting, which prevented them from doing mobilizations together. I also saw the big NGOs, the big NGOs, doing big actions to garner media attention, and they didn't seem that plugged in with the grassroots groups. And so, you know, once again, you have egos, you have something they call in Latin American protagonism. Everybody's just trying to be the most badass activist group out there instead of jointly going forward and making a larger splash as a massive group of people. In that sense, you know, not only did the talks fail behind closed doors, but I'm really sad to say that the movement is headed by or the so-called movement is headed by folks who are more interested in showing that they can do these actions and later garner more donations or more foundation money or whatever, where in the end the problem requires a much more visionary and a much more long-term view. And I just didn't see that in Cancun, unfortunately.
We're going to see that in some of your film, End Civ. I want to wrap up with that. First of all, what does End Civ stand for? And tell us a little bit about the film and how people can find it.
Yeah, the film End Civ means End of Civilization, and as I mentioned, is inspired by the works of Derek Jensen, in which his main premise or his main proposal is that civilization has to end for us to survive. And within that premise, he basically says that civilization is not and can never be sustainable. It's not a really hard idea to grasp, but I try to do my best to give Derek's work, which is an amazingly rich work, some justice. And people can see clips of the film, or they can buy the DVD at endciv.com. That's endciv.com.
Great. We've been talking with Franklin Lopez, and he's a producer and a multimedia kind of giant in a way, a one-man guy who also works with a team of other people, but is taking the idea of Be the Media to heart, and I think giving us a leadership role in that. So thanks a lot for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
And thanks for having me. I've been a fan for years.
Okay. This is Radio EcoShock, churning over the results of the 2010 COP16 climate talks in Cancun, Mexico. Our guest is British broadcaster and host of climate radio, Phil England. Phil, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
Well, these UN conferences are so complex. There's thousands of delegates, many speaking bureaucratic baffle-gab, it seems to me, and thousands more NGOs from all over the world speaking many languages. Help me hash through the results of this conference. So where would we start?
Well, there are lots of people that got good things to say about it. I mean, I think the main upside is that it has saved the multilateral process. The idea that all countries, all 193 countries in the world that are part of the UN can come together and try and work this out collectively so that everybody, in theory, has an equal say. That process, the UN process, has been saved, a lot of people are saying, because it has been on a very rocky road over the last few years. So I think that's a good outcome. It could have gone to kind of bilateral processes and more unrepresentative bodies like the G20, for example.
Firm limits to greenhouse gases were not set, but at least there was this shared vision, a goal of 2 degrees of warming maximum. Can you tell us a little about that?
The big downside, if you like, is that no rich country has agreed to raise their targets for cutting greenhouse gas emissions. Overall, we're still on a pathway towards catastrophic levels of climate change. That's the bottom line message. But in the text, developed country parties are urged to increase their ambition in line with the recommendations in the IPCC's latest report. But that would only give us a 50-50 chance of keeping within 2 degrees C. And of course, we also know from the last IPCC report that serious impacts are going to happen at lower temperatures than previously thought. And a majority of countries support a 1.5 degrees C target or lower. So it's a bit odd that they're still insisting on going with this unsafe target of 2 degrees C and not having any means of achieving it at all. Bolivia, of course, made a very principled stand in the last couple of hours of the negotiation, saying that it would not agree to a text that leads to a 4 degrees C world, and saying that this would implicate it in genocide and ecocide.
Phil, is the proposed $100 billion Green Fund real or more empty promises? What is your take?
Analysis have been done of the what's called the fast track funding, which was the money that rich countries promised to poor countries for signing on to the Copenhagen Accord from last year. Basically, hardly any of that is new money. What's starting to appear is that rich countries want to offer this money not as grants, but as in the form of loans. So the countries that have done nothing to cause the problem of climate change are being asked to pay for cleaning up the mess with interest on top. That's a very poor development. Also, this $100 billion that is being talked about for 2020, they're hoping to scale it up to $100 billion by 2020. It's very unclear as to where that money is going to come from. And there's a lot of talk about it coming from the carbon markets. And the problem with that is that it's a way for rich countries to buy their way out of emissions cuts at home. And it shifts the burden again, onto the poor countries, which is the wrong thing that should be happening. When you look at the deal that everybody signed, the framework that everybody's operating under in these talks is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change from 1992, which everybody, including the US, signed up to, and has a lot of stuff about fairness in it and who's responsible and who should be paying who. This is now all seems to be taking a rather strange turn, you know, that the rich countries are trying to do their best to wriggle out of their responsibilities.
It sounds like climate imperialism, really, the way you describe it.
Well, in a sense, and there's a very worrying trend, well, worrying question mark over the role of the World Bank in all of this. I mean, basically, the G77 plus China, the 130-odd countries that are the poor majority at the UN, are basically have had on the table for some years now an opposition to any involvement for the World Bank. I mean, they basically see it as it's the institution that has that turned poor countries into debt slaves, and it's continuing to fund fossil fuel projects, you know, right as of today. It's the organization that makes dirty development possible and has done nothing to reform itself. So the G77 plus China have their proposal that's been on the table for years now is that all climate finance should be under the democratic control of the UN and that there should be no role for the World Bank. It's unclear as to how that is going to play out over the next year, currently there is a token role for the World Bank, and the World Bank is making a big play to put itself at the center of all this in terms of its PR. But really, NGOs have got a lot of, and civil society have got a lot of work to do over the next year to try and to make that one come good.
How do you see the RED plan for protecting forests working out?
During the negotiations themselves, there were major concerns about the safeguards included in the forestry section of the agreement. Basically, there was no clear definition even of what constituted a forest, which essentially meant that you could have a perverse incentive in all this, where logging companies and countries could be essentially paid to cut down long-standing old-growth forests and replace it with short-growth timber for future logging. And for the climate, that's not a good solution at all. And it's been shown that one of the best ways for preserving the forest is actually to enhance the land rights of the indigenous people that actually live there. If we did that, there is evidence. There was a study in The New Scientist which said that that's the best way of protecting forests. It was a survey done over a number of years covering about 220 forests. A global study, and that was its conclusion. At the end of the conference, it's not a good sign that indigenous people are up in arms about what's currently on the table. So again, a lot of work to be done over the coming year.
We are talking over the Cancun Climate Conference results with Phil England, host of Climate Radio. Find his blog at climateradio.org. And you mentioned to me also in an email, Phil, that there is still a loophole for the rich countries. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, that's another thing which has been a firm decision on it has been put off until next year. But there's a rich country loophole called LULUCF, which is about land use change and forestry, and the way that rich countries account for that in their national emissions inventories. Essentially, it's been exposed as a big loophole. The good thing is that none of the bad options that are on the table haven't been agreed to. So again, there is still an opportunity for campaigners to get that one sorted satisfactorily over the coming year.
As we prepare for those next round of talks in Durban, South Africa in December 2011, do you have any more tips for listeners and activists, things they should be watching for or doing?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we have to show is that there are ways of raising finance to fund this climate deal so that we get adequate funding to pay poor countries' adaptation and climate changing impacts, and also to help them develop in a clean way. We need to show that we can get adequate funds for that that don't come from the carbon markets, that are realistic. And the best option that's on the table is the so-called Robin Hood tax. I don't know if you've come across that in Canada, but it's a big campaign here in the UK. It's a kind of rebranded take on the Tobin tax,
right,
which is this small tax on financial transactions. And it can raise, you know, hundreds of billions, just a very small tax. And that should really be given serious consideration. And I think a campaign, ramped up campaign for that, would be something seriously to get our teeth into next year.
I'm Alex Smith from the UK. You've been listening to longtime radio host Phil England helping with the Cancun Climate Conference wrap-up. Get more from my show blog at ecoshock.info and certainly from Phil's site. Check it out at climateradio.org. Phil England, you are one of the people I learn from, I have to tell you. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thanks, Alex. Always a pleasure to speak to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Just like football or baseball, when it comes to the global climate crisis, countries form teams of common interest. It's pretty hard to understand the negotiations game without even knowing the team names. The Americans we know, sure, and the European Union, but who are the G77, BASIC, ALBA, AOSIS? Do they matter? Can they influence the final outcome? And really, when you get down to it, do the annual United Nations climate conferences have any hope of saving our climate? Here to help us, especially with voices from the Global South, is New York-based writer Nicholas Kozloff. He has a doctorate in Latin American history from Oxford and two recent books, Revolution, South America and the Rise of the New Left in 2008, and in 2010, No Rain in the Amazon, How South America's Climate Change Affects the Entire Planet. Nicholas Kozloff has appeared on major television networks. Nicholas, it's great to have you back on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me. having me again.
Well, the 2010 COP16 summit, the annual attempt to save the climate, has wrapped up in Cancun, Mexico. Can you give us a brief rundown of the players, those country groups with the acronym names?
Sure. Well, you have obviously the European Union and the United States, and then you have this geopolitical bloc, which is fairly recent, called BASIC, which is Brazil, China, India, and South Africa. Then you have the G77, which is an older geopolitical bloc, which in theory represents the interests of impoverished third world countries, but which in practice has become a bit diffuse. Then you have AOSIS, which is the small island nations, which are very menaced and threatened by global climate change. And then, in addition, if that weren't befuddling enough, you have the ALBA countries, the more radical Latin American bloc that's been pushing a more ambitious climate change proposals in recent years.
What is going on with Brazil, and why is that country important to our climate?
I was cautiously optimistic at a certain point that activists might make a friendly overture towards Brazil in the hope that they might take a progressive stance on climate change. But since then, as a result of disclosures in the WikiLeaks scandal, I've come to reverse my position, and I'm very skeptical at this point that Brazil, unfortunately, will be able to counteract the United States, Europe, not to mention its counterparts in the BASIC group, China, India, and South Africa. I was initially a bit optimistic because in the first round of Brazil's presidential election, which occurred just recently, you had Marina Silva of the Green Party actually garnering 19% of the vote, which is really unprecedented. That's perhaps the level that you might expect the Green Party of Germany to achieve in an election. And so for a Green Party candidate to get that kind of vote share in Brazil is really unprecedented and should be welcomed. So I interpreted that as a sign that perhaps environmental consciousness was growing in Brazil. And for other reasons, I thought Brazil might be pliable in some ways because Brazil forms part of the pink tide of leftist regimes in South America, which have come to power in recent years. And so even though Brazil hasn't made climate change policy its major focus, like Bolivia, Venezuela, and Cuba, and those more radical Latin American countries, I figured that as long as Brazil is part of that pink tide wave, that maybe activists might be able to persuade it to take a more friendly or a more progressive stance. Unfortunately, I don't really see many signs of that. You ask Brazilian high officials, for example, the environment minister, Isabella Teixeira, who I had the opportunity to interview in New York when she came up to the United Nations, and they'll tell you that we have very good faith in the negotiating process. We're negotiating within BASIC. We're negotiating within the G77. Unfortunately, there were some recent disclosures which in the WikiLeaks scandal, which hinted that Brazil is maybe not an equal opportunity negotiator.
And they're becoming a major oil producer themselves. And I asked you, too, you know, why that country is so important to our climate. I know that you've written a book about the Amazon and the importance of the Amazon rainforest, but isn't Brazil also now the third largest emitter or something like that? Am I off base on that?
Yes. I think that historically, the United States, Europe, and maybe Russia have contributed greatly to global warming. And yet, in future decades, and already, it's increasingly the developing countries, China, India, and Brazil, that are going to play a more predominant role in global warming. And already, Brazil is the third largest emitter, and most people don't grasp that. And that's largely as a result of the deforestation in such sensitive ecological regions as the Amazon. And also, Brazil is going to develop offshore oil, and it's pursuing its great power projection into the Atlantic in the hopes of developing offshore oil reserves. But for the most part, its emissions are related to the deforestation. And unfortunately, because agribusiness is so politically connected in Brazil, it's difficult to see how Brazil is going to vastly clamp down on agribusiness, for example, even though the Lula administration has stated its aim to reduce deforestation, and in recent years there has been some reduction in deforestation, but it's politically rather dubious. And I think it's also a vast region in the Amazon that's difficult to enforce, and so difficult to protect from deforestation. I certainly welcome all of those initiatives, but I think that Brazil, despite its claims, is going to have to adhere to binding reductions as opposed to non-binding reductions. And that's been the problem in all of these international climate negotiations, because it's all non-binding at the end of the day. And who is to make sure that Brazil will actually reduce its deforestation? There's no international mechanism to ensure that that happens.
Yeah, well, you raise some really good points, because I think in the mechanics of the Cancun Climate Agreement, there has been a lot of hoopla about the forest protection. RED, as it's called, R-E-D-D, is one of the bright spots. But it seems that in their industrial tree farms count as forests, and you're still allowed sustainable use like logging. There's no protection for Aboriginal people that I can see. What is your take about this forest agreement?
I'm a little skeptical about capitalistic means to reduce deforestation. And so basically, I think ideally the global north should just reduce its own emissions as opposed to somehow protecting nations of the global south from deforestation. It's sort of a bizarre approach to reducing emissions. That said, I'd be open to the notion of a RED program. My concern also is that who is going to disperse these climate change funds? And if you notice in Cancun, one of the results of the conference was that they agreed that the World Bank would be dispersing the funds. I have severe reservations about that. I think Robert Zoellick, who is the United States Trade Representative during the Bush administration, was lobbying hard for the World Bank to disperse the funds in addition to Japan and the usual suspects. And so given the World Bank's environmentally dubious record in the third world, I don't think that they should be the ones that are dispersing funds for RED, for example.
Well, right. I mean, the World Bank has been funding coal plants and other very destructive climate things. And, you know, a lot of the suspect characters seem to be kept employed by this Cancun Agreement, things like the Clean Development Mechanism, which has been horribly abused in some places. And then the Wall Street traders, they're going to be thrilled to see they get a climate trading mechanism to make money trading on pollution. Do we have to be anti-capitalist to say that these things have already shown they're very unlikely to work?
I certainly share your skepticism on those grounds. And moreover, I think that even though it's claimed that this Cancun Climate Summit was an incredible success, and you read the glowing press reports, I'm a little skeptical that we're going to be able to make the kinds of climate change reductions that are called for.
You have been listening to Nicholas Kozloff on Radio EcoShock. I recommend Kozloff's latest book, No Rain in the Amazon. Find out more at his website, nicholaskozloff.com. If you have trouble finding that, you can get that link and many more in my blog entry on the Cancun Climate Talks at ecoshock.info. That's it for our Radio EcoShock Cancun Climate Summit coverage. You heard Dr. Robert Stavins from Harvard, Damon Moglen at Friends of Earth USA, Franklin Lopez, the anarchist filmmaker from the Mexican climate scene, British radio broadcaster Phil England with the European perspective, a real treat to have the host of Climate Radio on the air, and South American expert and author Nicholas Kozloff on Brazil, Bolivia, and the Road Not Taken. If you tuned in partway or want to listen again, download this free MP3 from our website at ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith, going hard to give you a ringside seat as humans decide whether to sink or swim. Thank you for listening.